forward-looking relationship with Japan, which should now be an ally. You see, I know they make it difficult. Then South Korea will be that much weaker. And China, I'm almost glad about all this bullying that's going on post-Thaad, because I think any last illusions that China, was kind of on your side, the historic hegemon, etc. No, absolutely not. I mean, incredibly unsubtle. Take them to the WTO. Whoever wins the next South Korean election, I hope, will prosecute them. And then North Korea. Oh, my goodness, what can we do? History having gone backwards. I can remember naively hoping, I thought there was a conflict, there was a tragic division of Korea, there was a terrible, terrible war, it must absolutely never happen again. And things that were happening, I thought, just took us step by step forwards. That's what I used to think. And I'm so old, I can remember loads of them. Even under Chun Doo-hwan, everyone always forgets this one, a year after they nearly killed him in Yangon, North Korean ships docked in South Korean harbors, bringing rather bad concrete and medicines, which you definitely ought not to try. They were quietly warehoused, I believe. Then in the 1990-92, we had the Prime Minister's talks, and all that even before the sunshine period. And I thought, right, we're definitively, little by little, we are going forward. It has not worked that way. So I conclude, being a sociologist, I have to use occasional long words. There is no teleology. There is no movement towards an end state, in general or on the Korean Peninsula. Neither collapse nor unification are inevitable. I might come back to a little bit of that at this time. And also, please, whatever intellectual tools you equip yourself with and whatever side you're on politically, please do not think you can solve the North Korean situation by ideology. There are people out there, and how I envy them their certainties, who are absolutely sure if we were only just that bit properly tough on North Korea, then they would have come crawling to us by now. There are people who are equally sure that if we are only just that bit nicer to North Korea, they would have come crawling to us by now. I think I'm more in the latter camp. Neither of these has worked very well. It really is, as people keep saying, it's the problem with absolutely no good options. Here's one of the reasons why they're so, and this is perhaps obvious, but I don't know what we can do about it. I have written down space-time disequilibria, but I have no idea why I did that. All I mean is that the trouble is we are not one. There is this, one of the things I hate is too strong a word, but I'm incredibly unimpressed by all the grandstanding of the last year, and the world community stands against this, the world community stands against that. We can pass all the UN resolutions we like, and I don't mean that they don't deserve to be passed and so on, but let us not sort of delude ourselves as to what is accomplished by doing this. Interests vary. I mean, one of the oldest, hoariest things, and one of the things that the Trump administration seems to have inherited from its predecessors, is expecting China to do America's heavy lifting or anybody else's. They ain't going to, for reasons that we've heard. China has its own interests. It's possible that how it will define its interests may change a bit over time. Maybe Kim Jong-un will one day annoy China so much that China's policy will change, but it hasn't happened so far. Secondly, under democracy, of course, our own governments change. This is about to happen in South Korea, almost certainly, if the polls are correct. Moon Jae-in is going to make it, and he seems to be a fairly unreconstructed advocate of the sunshine policy, and he's going to try to put out some sort of feelers to North Korea. I'm not sure what the details are as to how you'll do that in the very different world that we're in now, but I mean, that's one example. Of course, we've seen it many times before. I think notably when George W. Bush succeeded Bill Clinton. Remember where we were at that particular point at the turn of the century? Have I got that right? Yeah, I'm so old I forget which year it was. But anyway, we had North Korea's nukes, the ones we knew about anyway, under lock and key and IAEA, so hard to say that, inspection. And the Clinton administration, had he been able to continue, was just about to start talking about missiles. And one of the very first things George W. Bush did before he wised up a few years later and did start talking to the North Koreans was to stop the missile talks. His Secretary of State, Colin Powell, thought that wasn't a very good idea, and I'm tempted to agree with Colin Powell on that one. So we get this. Bipartisanship, either through time or across space between allies, is almost impossible, and of course North Korea exploits that. They exploit it very, very skillfully. Just want to say a couple of other things. There is one factor, I think, that was neglected in sort of last year's hawk heaven. Let me put it this way. When he fired the fourth nuke in early last year, I thought, and this may sound complacent, I thought, well, there he goes again. I wasn't surprised. We had them every 3 years. He did speed up since. And he was bound to do it this year because he was going to have a party congress. Have we perhaps failed to consider sufficiently the internal political dynamics of North Korea? Kim Jong-un, young, inexperienced leader, a lot of people thought that he wouldn't make it. He presumably has to impress older people, generals, and so on. How do you impress people in the North Korean system? Loyalty. Loyalty is the sort of supreme virtue. And so, therefore, he would have to have a nuclear test. He would have to fire missiles. Okay, the pace has considerably accelerated, and I don't in any way mean to downplay the challenge. But it did seem to me that probably he'd had to do that. The Kim Jong-un factor in another way as well, the character of Kim Jong-un, this has been alluded to some degree. I do worry. I mean, he's by repute hot-headed. And I say repute, I remember the quality of intelligence that we have on this. Does anyone remember that we didn't know this man existed for years and years and years? We were assured, what does the CIA do with your money? What does the, or our lot as well, that Kim Jong-il had two sons, daughters, sadly not counting. Oh no, there's a third, and it takes a sort of dodgy Japanese sushi chef, who apparently has now opened a restaurant in Pyongyang, so clearly his variety of kiss and tell doesn't get you killed, whereas Kim Jong-nam's did. Figure that one out if you can. So he's the one who actually told the world, oh, actually there's a third son, and he's his dad's favorite because he's hot-headed and so on. So we seem to have been playing catch-up a long time. I do worry about hot-headed people with their control of the nuclear button, and now we've got another in Washington. So, it's not something you can be complacent about, is it? So how do we conclude? I again, perhaps controversially. I just remember there was one other unpopular thing I wanted to say. Sorry, can I get back? I missed out a section. We have to, if we ever do deal with North Korea, we have to prioritize. So this, and I'm sorry, my heart is going to bash my head over the head for what I'm about to say. The whole human rights detour. If ever the North Korean regime starts showing any seriousness about talking about nukes, are we going to hear a word about human rights? Can we? Don't we have to prioritize? I mean, it hurts. I'm glad, who wasn't glad to see North Korea shamed like that? But taking him to the International Criminal Court, it's precisely, as some press reports recently have reminded us, it's precisely because North Korea was urged to follow the example of that sensible Colonel Gaddafi and give things up, and then, you know, look what happened to him. There are real fears. So, I mean, I think the West, South Korea, all actors involved have to think hard and make unpalatable choices about policy priorities. No one should shut up about anything, except me shortly, which I will. But it's a question of policymakers at some point will have to decide what to prioritize. Back to my conclusion. How big a threat is North Korea? Now, again, without wanting to sound complacent, and I'm not a nuclear security specialist, and I don't like anything that's happening one little bit, but what scares me is that in my country and lots of countries like it, there are young people growing up who have a very perverse universalistic ideology and who somehow get convinced that God has told them that it's okay to go and kill and rape and enslave people, and they go and do it. And this metastasizes. It's a kind of cancer. I don't mean to overplay it, but it's out there, that which produces ISIS. That scares me. That's what scares me. One thing that reassures me about North Korea, it doesn't really reassure me, but North Korea is alone. I mean, it is the pompous bombast, the narcissism. There are no friends left. There has to be a way we can use that somehow, can't there? Maybe it's to squeeze them in, but that doesn't seem to work very well. Or maybe, and the really unpalatable conclusion that I come to is at some point, you take advantage of Kim Jong-un's expressed desire for economic development, and you buy the bastards off. And I will end on that. Sorry.
That was another dose of realism, I guess. Please, now it's your time. So I will give you the floor in a minute. I want to just encourage students as well. But if I take these two questions here and your questions. So please. And please introduce yourself. Up there, sorry.
My name is Bruce, and I'm a student in ALC for economic history. I have a question for Ambassador Ong Jun. And the question is about the third defense system. Some experts in China said that the third defense system is for the long range missiles. So they think that the system is a tool used by the United States against China. Could you make comments? Thank you.
So one question down here. In the middle, the woman.
Hi, my name is Fan. I'm from China, but I also learned Korean and Greek.
Seems a bit dodgy, that mic.
I think we have that mic is not very dependable, so I think.
Okay, so my question is for Mr. Oh and Professor Brown. Mr. Oh, you have stated that dialogue is it's a third scenario in your speech. But as we know, the six parties talk was kind of the only dialogue among America, China, Russia, and the Korean Peninsula. But it has been suspended since 2008. And right now, we know Trump doesn't want doesn't want to have a conversation with North Korea. So under what circumstance will the dialogue work among all these countries? And also, Professor Brown, I'm very interested in your fourth point, the leadership. But Zhang Dejiang has become the third, the number three people in power in China since 2008. But the situation between China and North Korea has been kind of like going down since then. And he probably will retire at the end of this year after the 19th National Congress of Communist Party. So I'm wondering what kind of role is he playing in this game? And is he an effective factor in this
game? So let me take this three sets of questions. So it's about the sort of technical question about the missile system and the long range and short range, and you alluded to this in your remarks. The second one is on the six-party dialogue, what works and what doesn't work. And of course, in a way, the six-party dialogue was also a way for these countries to talk to each other about something, not necessarily just North Korea. And the last question is you, and for Professor Brown on the changes in the Politburo and how that might affect. So please, Ambassador Oh.
Well, the third defense system is a sticky issue. And I understand your name is Bruce. Bruce's question, was not entirely correct because you said that that is targeted at long-range missile defense. Actually, it's targeted at high-altitude missile defense. THAAD itself is an acronym of Terminal High Altitude. I forgot what AD is, but anyway, high altitude.
Area?
Aerial defense, yeah, aerial defense. Anyway, you are right that long-range missiles would not reach South Korea. Long-range missiles would fly over Japan. Even mid-range missiles would not reach South Korea. But if you look at what North Koreans were doing last year, Minister Kim of my embassy earlier said that they conducted 24 missile tests last year alone. And if you look at them, there are several tests that look like failure, because they shot mid-range missiles with a very high trajectory. So mid-range missiles, if you fire it normally, it's gonna fall somewhere near Japan or over Japan. But if you shoot it with a very high trajectory, it's going to fall pretty close, like within 500 kilometers. Why do you do that? Because they cannot carry nuclear bombs on short-range missiles yet. The way I see it, only the United States and Russia can do that. No countries in the world currently can mount nuclear weapon on short-range missiles. Short-range missiles meaning flying less than 500 kilometers. So they are trying to shoot mid-range missiles short distance. Why do they want to do that? And they are trying to shoot it with very high altitude. And that's why we need that. But I can see how China has other concerns, like, you know, because the SAAT system will have a very good radar system, and it might be used for targeting Chinese missiles. So that's what China is worried about. But that should be dealt with in the context of strategic competition between the United States and China, not South Korea. You know, as far as we are concerned, we are only concerned about targeting North Korean missiles, probably flying with nuclear weapons, which is a disaster for us. So we should stop it no matter what. And dialogue. Might not work because Trump administration doesn't want it. But actually, what Trump administration made clear is that they are not gonna continue with what is called the strategic patience policy. So they hinted at dialogue when Mr. Trump was a candidate 1 year before his inauguration. He said something like, probably there is 10 or 20% chance of me talking the North Koreans out of them nukes. So we don't exactly know what he meant, but because the United new administration has not come up with comprehensive policies for dealing with North Korea, but Mr. Tillerson's visit is revealing a little bit of what it's going to be. Like, that's why I said probably there are more prospects for dialogue and confrontation than pressure.
Okay. Professor Brown?
On Zhang Dejiang, so in the past, there's usually been one, in the Hu Jintao period, I think that they had a kind of real memory of fighting in the Korean War in the early 1950s and a bigger emotional bond. So people like Woo Bang-guo, who I think was the number two in the Politburo then, you know, kind of really believed that North Korea was a brother, you know, socialist brother. And I think Hu Jintao in 2006, they gave this very hilarious speech about the delightful achievements of North Korean socialism. That's about as poetic as you can get for Hu Jintao. I mean, delightful achievements. It's just pure poetry from the man of only one joke on Wikipedia. And so this generation, and then Zhang Dejiang, I mean, he was in Dandong, you know, for a while, and so he does have experience, but when you look at the likely new leaders, well, none of them do. And so I think that will have an impact. There's not this emotional link. It's a very structural and pragmatic thing. And it's, does this help us achieve our great nation status or not? And I would respectfully say that it probably doesn't. It's an impediment. And I don't know at what point the Chinese leadership start to think, okay, this is actually a very big violation of our strategic vision, and we matter and you don't. And, you know, that's when it could get nasty.
Okay, I'm going to allow one more round of questions because we started a bit late. So I had one here, one there, and one there.
Hi, my name's Tim. I'm from the University of Bath. So my question is about the predictability. People typically, like as a throwaway line, kind of characterize Kim Jong-un as an unpredictable character. But the more I've learned about South Korea, is that the first time I heard about this time of year, that the tension between North and South Korea was up increasing, I was absolutely terrified. 5 years on from first learning about South Korea, I can see that kind of it's an annual sort of also a time frame. Although no one told me about the sirens which go off in Seoul, so I was a little bit lost at one point. So my question is, who really finds Kim Jong-un unpredictable? And we've already discussed today that these nuclear tests were predicted in terms of a time period. So what? Yeah.
By most standards, I think he's not very predictable. But let's, please.
Hi, I'm Sang Jun Kim, student here at LSE. I have a question to Mr. Oh. What if Trump government take a conference strategy and try to attack the missile camp in North Korean territory? Does our government have a negotiation power against that strategy? And then is there any effective way that Korean citizens to incorporate our opinion against the U.S. strategy? Thank you.
Yeah. And I had one over here. Yeah, I think. Well, okay, you take. Sorry, I forgot.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Griffin, researcher at Yanxing Academy at Peking University. My question is for Mr. Juna. I was specifically wondering if you could comment on the role and the effectiveness of non-military sanctions against North Korea, especially how we can reconcile the moral and humanitarian aspects of non-military sanctions, specifically because you mentioned how sanctions have been increasing over the time, but North Korea's nuclear capacity has been developing. Last year, they launched two nuclear tests. So, and a particular image that comes to my mind, which is the one famously known of North Korea at night, where you see Seoul is very bright and Pyongyang is very bright, but the rest of the country is very dark. And I kind of have a different analysis of this image, which is that these sanctions, the ones that they're targeting, the elites and the nuclear development, is not working in the sense that Pyongyang is still very bright, whereas the everyday citizens are still in the dark. Reconcile these differences.
I'm going to allow one question up here because I forgot about him before. Jonathan Pollock, please.
Compliment all the speakers. Let me just very quickly, because I will have an opportunity to talk this afternoon, try to clarify a few matters that are often bandied about in this discussion. President Obama never said American policy was strategic patience. He somewhat differently. It's something between indifference and contempt. And in a lot of ways, that probably bugged North Korea more than a different way of putting it. But so let me see very, very quickly, if I could, to clarify, why has the deliberation and debate changed? And a lot of it has to do with the technology. Ambassador Oh gave a very compelling presentation. He made a comparison to India and Pakistan, but there's an enormous difference between North Korea and India and Pakistan, and it's not just because India and Pakistan were not signatories to the NPT. The testing program that India and Pakistan undertook was literally within a few days of one another in a very, very concentrated form in 1998. All the nuclear weapons tests undertaken by India and Pakistan were in that very compressed period. Indeed, the critical instrument that enabled those testings was a screwdriver, because these were weapon systems that were ready to go on short order when a political decision was made, first in India and then in Pakistan, to proceed to actualize what had been an ongoing covert program on which both both countries had lied repeatedly. They were just ready to go once the decision was taken. In North Korea now, we're looking at something that has happened from the first test in 2006 until now that has been a very, very protracted process. And I think, to me at least, the obvious conclusion is that North Korea wasn't ready to undertake these highly concentrated sequential, their tests are sequential, but over a longer period of time. So what we have now is a widespread belief that North Korea is on the verge of operationalizing a nuclear weapons deterrent. I dare say that Kim Jong-un would like us to believe he is on the cusp of operationalizing a deterrent. But then the question becomes, what kind of a deterrent? If Mr. Kim is to be believed, it will only be ultimately when North Korea has a capability to reach the continental United States that the goals will in some sense be fulfilled. But he's kind of promised us to test, but we'll note that he has not undertaken it. And it has been my long-term view that we should not give North Korea credit for things that it has not done, period. So the problem with that position, if you might say, and this will be my last concluding comment for now, is that there's only one way to really prove if you have a capacity to launch and detonate a nuclear weapon on a missile, and that's to do it. Would North Korea dare? This is one international norm that North Korea, whether for reasons of prudence or otherwise, has not violated. There has been no nuclear weapons test in the atmosphere atop a missile now in 36 years. The last such test was by China in 1980, but it wasn't constrained by any kind of formal obligations at that point. This is where the fact that North Korea is, shall we say, geographically challenged compounds the problems. What would your options be if indeed you wanted to demonstrate that you could do it? So the dilemma now, and what is shaping a lot of the debate in the United States, for better or for worse, is a belief that, well, this becomes more credible with time. North Korea, we've seen Kim Jong-un adoringly looking at what we were told was a prototype of a deployable weapon. They claim that their fifth test, in fact, was of a warhead. How do we know that? How would we know that? And that's the dilemma that we all have as we deal with the reality of not so much a problem, an issue that of quote-unquote provocations. I think that this is a very inadequate label that we all rely on. This is a developmental logic of a program. Whether we like it or not, and we obviously don't like it, there are reasons that they do what they do, or at least he's put a lot of his eggs in these baskets. And the question is whether there are any kind of realistic ways in which that can be turned around or defended against or what have you. And that's the policy issue that I think everyone confronts right now. I'll stop at that. I have no questions. These are just points of clarification.
Okay. Thank you. And I think it does relate to the issue of predictability. It's something, it's true, as said, it's a kind of throwaway line around the North Korea, but, you know, there is, some system to the madness that we can detect, and of course, in economics, you know, we have this idea that you can actually signal that you are crazy, and that will be, a very successful strategy if you can convince your counterpart that you are actually crazy. And we see some examples of this being, this particular strategy being played out around the world at the moment. Please, can you address this issue?
The question of Kim Jong-un's unpredictability, good question. I would not like in any way to endorse the kind of tabloid stereotype. I mean, if you ever read articles about Kim Jong-un in tabloid newspapers, and he's staple fare of tabloids. I mean, you sometimes think maybe some sort of computer writes these crackpot, tin pot, dictator, you know, crazy loon finger on. I mean, you can imagine it. As against that, I think I join with a number of other scholars and analysts in suggesting that, on the whole, there are broad rationalities at work. They may not be our rationality or the ones that we like. I mean, clearly the race to beef up the missile and nuclear threat and to combine them is going on. However, I detect, and you can't really prove this one way or the other, there seems to me to be some sort of a new element since Kim Jong-un took over. I mean, there have been analyses of past provocations. A Japanese scholar wrote a book about these. And usually, when North Korea did something bad, it usually wanted something. It usually wasn't that hard to work out why they were doing this at this particular time. I'm not sure that that now obtains in the same way. I mean, not to go on at length, but shutting the Kaesong zone, of course, both Koreas have now done that, South Korea, definitively. But why exactly did, what particular challenge was he trying to make to Park Geun-hye by withdrawing all the workforce from the zone? And then at that, of course, in those days, she worked very patiently and very successfully to reopen it. I was thinking, what was that about? Or I think I could also, under this heading, something very important that Minister Ryu or Professor Minister Ryu told us. Remember, you may have seen it in print as well, which staggered me and disappointed me. That's because I'm still too optimistic. I clutch at hope. So when the big three from North Korea, as he reminded us, came down to Seoul, or at least to Incheon, at that time, he thought, oh, something must be going on. And no, there was no message. What exactly is going on if you take the trouble to send your big three guys to South Korea and you don't send a message of any kind? I suppose that means that I don't understand, if anybody does, the decision-making process around Kim Jong-un. We have the same problem about the Trump White House now to compound our problems. It's quite hard to know who decides, who's restraining, who's doing that. So in that, I do think there is a new element of uncertainty and unpredictability in that sense. Kim Jong-il, I think, in his calculating way, was quite cautious. I worry that Kim Jong-un is not as cautious as his father.
Ambassador Oak, maybe you can provide a little bit of texture to this question as well, and then maybe answer a few of the other questions. Please.
Yeah, thank you. Well, unpredictability has already been taken care of. But I think it's more about the lack of legitimacy, power legitimacy, of Kim Jong-un than him being unpredictable, you know. He is trying to make up for the lack of legitimacy by doing, in my opinion, stupid things. And that's dangerous. So in a way, he's not unpredictable, he's predictable, if you consider him as trying to make up for his lack of power legitimacy. And another question about, you know, what if the Americans shoot down North Korean missiles? What can the South Korean government do about it? It's a tough question, but if the Trump administration is out of the strategic patience policy, so out of waiting out North Korea until the sanctions take effect, then I think, as I presented, you know, there will be either dialogue or confrontation. And confrontation, if the Americans shoot down North Korean missile flying towards the U.S., usually even in international law, it is considered exercising self-defense. Even if you take out North Korean missile on the ground that is being fueled, probably it's also considered preemptive self-defense. But usually in international law, preventive self-defense is not allowed. So it's different. But preemptive self-defense is usually allowed. So, but still, whether or not it's legitimate in international law, what kind of response will come from North Korea is a big question, and it's very dangerous all the same. So it's a very dangerous situation, and I think that's why we need good crisis management. And effectiveness of non-military sanctions, you said Pyongyang has still bright night sky. I think sanctions will be effective. You know, if you consider the two sanctions resolutions adopted last year, you know, they have been there only less than a year, so they have not taken full effect yet. But if you look at them, you know, I don't know of any other country that can survive after cutting down one quarter of its total exports. You know, South Korea certainly cannot. And some people talking about China cheating. But, you know, there was a report yesterday that China allowed 10 North Korean ships carrying coal into the port. I don't think China will cheat, but even if there is some loopholes, you know, we are talking about $700 million cutoff, cut down from North Korean export. You know, if you add, for example, 1 million, what difference does it make? You cannot really, you know, cheat most of your export, you know, even if there might be loopholes. So, you know, by and large, North Korea will suffer. But as I said, even so, I don't know if the U.S. and South Korean administration have appetite for waiting out North Korea right now, especially after you discounted strategic patient policy officially. And about the missile capability, in comparison to Indian and Pakistani cases, I agree with you that both countries conducted tests in a very short period of time, and North Korea has taken time. But last year they did it, you know, with only the interval of 8 months. But no countries in the world tested flying nuclear weapon. Not that I know of. Neither North Korea will do that. So this is all assumption. You never seen Indian missiles carrying nuclear bomb and worked, you know. You never seen Pakistani missile carrying nuclear. So this is all assumptions. So we work on assumptions on North Korea.
Well, thank you very much. I won't attempt to summarize this panel, but certainly the bottom line is very sobering, we spoke about predictability, but you know, and we mean maybe different things. But the context of North Korea does not offer much solace, I'm afraid. So I think we have set the stage for the rest of the conference, and I'm very grateful to the speakers for shedding so much light on these issues. So thank you, and a big hand of applause, I think. I'm very much aware that we have drawn over time, but we started late. Can we say that we rejoin at 20 past? Is that fine? So please be back here at 20 past.
Yeah, we're just going to have a coffee break now. Yes, as Professor said, we'll be back by 12:20, not 12:15, 12:20. If you guys have any questions, look out for the guys with red badges. They will help you out. They are the stewards today. And toilets are just upstairs onto your right. And please, can you not leave any belongings in this room? Even though this room will be opened, please do not leave your belongings. at least phones and wallets, things like that. Thank you very much.
Testing 1 2 1 2. Testing 1 2 1 2. Testing 1 2. Testing 1 2. Testing 1 2 1 2.
Sorry, I just put the projector on off,
okay.
But
no worries. Yeah. Be aware if you do that, sometimes it does take an awful long time to
Oh really?
Yeah,
sorry.
That's right.
Okay.
Just wait for these guys to finish doing what they're doing.
So so there's no like freezing button on this, is there?
No.
Okay.
No,
there's usually some like projectors, they have that freezing mechanism, just freezes the projector unless you do whatever you want to do. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
What I'll do is I'll actually put it onto the desktop so you can then have your USB back, and when you come up, just click on the desktop. And
all right.
So I'll save, we'll save it to there.
All right.
Don't forget your clicker as well if you need that.
Mm-hmm. The mic.
I've changed it for you.
Oh, okay.
Like a,
cheers.
I guess there's like an animation in like one of the slots.
yet. I'm not quite sure whether the speaker
any of these people have
controlled it with this.
Should be able to. I think
PowerPoints.
When they go on to that, we should test it in a second.
I think they probably will.
But,
sorry, guys, do you want to do your thing first?
Yeah.
Let me just save this.
Save that to the desktop as well if you want. If it makes life easier for you. I have called. There's a folder on there called Saturday for you.
Is oh, yeah, that's
it. Yeah, Saturday 18th. So just thanks, save it and then you know where you want it.
Yeah,
I can load my PowerPoint file to that.
Yeah, to the same place.
Yeah, jump right into the context. Yeah, this is done.
Minimize these. Yeah. Got a lot up here. Minimize that.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Looks like it's working. This one?
That's the one.
I did it. Yes. So one is in PPT.
Yeah.
It's PPT. Yeah, PPT.
The PPT one.
Yes.
Okay, we'll just check when it copies over that that works, okay?
Yes.
And this is why you need a logistics team.
We just go through as if you would.
Mm-hmm.
No.
We'll see if we can get to the animation.
Right.
Do we have a 5-man
power?
4-man
power? I don't know if there is any animation in
this. Mm. Or like...
Yeah, 4-man.
I can ask the speaker now.
Yeah, ask him what part's supposed to be animated.
Okay.
I'll leave that there for a minute. Guys, what do you want me to do about the projector? Are you alright turning it back on yourselves?
Tell me at least how to put it on.
Right, so all you do, lectern source.
Yep.
Lectern PC.
Yep.
And it will take a while, but it will come back on.
Okay, so you've put it on right now?
No. Okay. Do you want me to put it on?
Yeah, could you just put it on?
Fine, and then you just should. You've got to give it a second. Come back onto the middle.
Okay, cheers. Could I fit all this now?
Yeah, you can do, yeah. Just minimize that.
Thanks a lot. Are you here for the whole day?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm here all day for you guys.
Thanks a lot.
I've changed one of the handhelds for you, so you've got two that won't cut out. Hopefully. I don't know why that one's reception keeps dropping off.
Yeah.
For some reason. Dual screen now. Well, I've got dual screen.
Mr. Ian Bennett, UK.
You can probably eject that USB as well if you want now, because you've got it saved to the desktop.
Yeah.
You've got the little wires, the HDMI, VGA, and the adapter on
you. Oh, yeah, like, I'll get it back.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks a lot.
That's
all right,
don't
worry. 조선이 이거 유로 해, 오로 해?
아 그냥 온
것
같아 얘네들
오케이 얘네 형들 오케이 오케이 누구 형?
세어 축하
이분 아 이분이 이분이
이분이
부스트네 프로페서?
Yes.
Okay.
Miss Monique Macias.
아 이분이 그 북한에서
오래 사신 분. Author of I Am Monique from Pyongyang.
you just make sure that people know how to bring people in again? Yeah. Okay, thanks. Oh, right. I saw her around earlier.
Yeah, I don't know where she's gone with it.
Maybe she's taken it. I'm not too sure. But no, she was using it and then it wasn't
then,
working.
Yeah,
so
she went
out
to the handheld, didn't she? Yeah. But I don't know where she's put it.
Someone must have it. Yeah. Then she's recording everything. Okay. She. Oh, wait, no, she wasn't. I'm not too sure. Oh, is it? Actually, no. They're just some wires. Junseong, 아까 그 아까 통역하신 분이 이거 들고 있었잖아, handheld. 그게 없어졌어. 어? 연합뉴스에서
녹음한 거 좀 달래.
연합뉴스에서? 오케이. 감사합니다.
감사합니다. 저희 마지막 패널 때 하시면 될 것 같아요. 마지막 얘기. 네, 세 분 정도 계시는데 비주얼에서 하시고 비주얼에서 안 연구하실 것 같고 그 다음에 Q&A 때 연구하시고 Q&A랑 패널 디스커션 때.
I found the.
Pretty good turnout.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder whether there's been some three-line whip from the teacher. Sometimes you can't be sure.
I'll say.
Can I borrow one of these pens?
Yeah. Don't write my name though.
That's right. I was looking for something clever, and you got.
I can give you a black pen if you'd rather. I've got more in my bag.
I'm not superstitious.
Hi.
Yes, I met you. Okay,
you met me. Yes.
Testing 1, 2.
Okay. Clock.
Last, right?
Yes.
Because I
am just. Yes. Did you decided against slides, right?
Yeah, I so. Did.
Okay. There's no and it's only 5 minutes after all, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I applaud your decision.
I'm going to need 10.
I applaud your decision.
Yeah. I was told you you have many things to say.
I do, actually.
Curtis reliably informed me. That's fine.
But I've set the framework along the way that you have outlined it.
Okay.
I'm going to start with some historical perspective from the depth of the famine.
Okay.
My first visit.
Okay.
What I saw and what I heard. And then I'll contrast that with 2013 when Kim Jong-un had really started to get his own framework in place. And I had another visit. And then I want to talk about four themes of change.
I'm the only one using PowerPoint.
Okay. That are current.
Okay.
That'll set a framework.
You guys will queue it up when I get up there.
Very
so
good.
I just have
as long as it doesn't undermine the questions that then come in the conversation.
Yeah.
That'll work. That's
no,
good.
No, I think it'll go from historical. I'll put some historical markers down. And then talk about the dynamics that have been unleashed.
Okay, sounds good.
Yes, this one. Oh.
You want to do what?
It's geopolitical.
Yeah,
you got
the only one.
It's Saturday.
Yeah, 일단 이거 띄워놓고.
You get a reputation. Now you get a reputation.
네. 그럼 내가 여기서 지금
Did you fly in the?
We went yesterday from Boston.
You gonna introduce?
Wow.
We had 18 inches of snow two days before.
We did. I flew in from DC and we had snow too. Yeah.
We got the same snow.
Right.
And it all turned to frozen sleet.
Yeah. Now ours came in very light, but it was a real nor'easter, and so the drifting was enormous.
How does that even get in?
2.5 feet of snow to shovel. My walk.
Well, I didn't have it that bad. I had 2 inches.
Saying we had 18 inches of snow 3 days ago.
I was in Toronto.
Were you?
2 days last week. It wasn't that bad up there, but they had been predicting snowmageddon. But they're very good clearing the roads. I'm sure you are in the Northeast in general.
Now we had 18 inches, and by 7 in the morning you could drive.
Amazing,
you
know? Isn't it? The UK would be out of commission for weeks.
So but we have bought recently property close to the Shard. So I'm still, of course. Scattered. Big building.
이거 어떻게 키니?
Our size. And you may have seen recently on the road.
Ah.
The massive. building.
너가 내가 이거 하고 나갈 테니까 너가 이거 하고
It's air quality and all that.
Bradley, then Curtis, then Peroshka, so it runs across. Right to left.
Melvin이 언제 두 번째 두 번째?
I used to live in Berkshire, and so in Berkshire, it's out on the Reading line. And so when I was in high school, I would come down here and hang out.
I'm told that the speaker, not the speaker, the chair, what's her name? Jean Best. That she delivered many hundreds of questions to the people who are taking part in the panel she's chairing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
If you had received hundreds of questions, would that have helped you?
No.
There's plenty enough to say as it is.
I think. I know. This, I mean, we could do a whole conference on any one of these.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's topical. I was in Ottawa last weekend and Brookings the week before.
You sent me your... Yeah. That was from that Brookings trip, was it?
Yeah, that was the Brookings one. I did a different one for the Canadians. It's interesting. They're trying to find a role for a middle power to be helpful with an eye on longer-term developments that they can try to influence in positive ways. It's an interesting issue for the middle countries.
It is. I mean, it's a bit like Britain's approach. Yeah. Hello? At the moment, there's no appetite for real engagement. So just
sorry, could we please have silence? Sorry. Welcome back to the second panel after the break. My name is Jiho Kim, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to you the second panel. It's entitled Economic Changes, Marketization and Reforms. Mr. Christopher Green, the researcher in Korean Studies at Leiden University, who is the chair of the panel, will start the panel by giving a short introduction about the speakers and the structure of the panel as well. Over to you.
Splendid. Thank you for that, and thank you for your organizational skills in the last few weeks. Endless stream of very timely emails. We're joined for this panel on marketization and economic reform by Mr. Bradley Babson, a consultant on Asian affairs, currently the chair of the DPRK Economic Forum at the US Career Institute, and a member of the Advisory Council of KEI and on the steering committee of the National Committee for NK, North Korea, spent 26 years at the World Bank prior to all of those things. To his left, as I'm sitting, is Mr. Curtis Melvin, a researcher at USKI as well, a contributor to 38 North Radio Free Asia, and editor of the long-running and quite well-known North Korea Economy Watch blog, but moreover, one of the most innovative open-source researchers on the North Korean economy that you're likely to find. And finally, at the end, Ms. Piroshka Nagimohasi, I'm afraid I will have brutalized your surname, I apologize. Fortunately, we're on first-name terms from here on in. Piroshka is a program director at the Institute of Global Affairs here at LSE, so I'm sure you all know her very well. Previously director at the Office of the Chief Economist of EBRD, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and prior to that of the IMF. Also author of the 2000 book, The Meltdown of the Russian State, which discusses, pertinently enough, collapse in the role of the Russian state in 1990s Russia in comparative perspective, and it is that comparative perspective that we're hoping to get here from her. So, in accordance with the plan laid down by the organizers, each of the presenters will give a 5 or maybe slightly more minute opening remarks. Then we'll move on to sort of talking amongst ourselves, as it were, for a few more minutes, and then we'll open up the floor for Q&A. So to get all of that done in the time allowed, so that everyone can get to lunch, without further ado, Brad, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, well, thank you. First, I just want to congratulate the students at LSE for organizing this conference. I think it's a wonderful and very timely. You're very lucky with the timing. It's so topical today. So I just really appreciate your interest and initiative. I want to talk first about North Korea when I first visited it at the depth of the famine in 1998. It was the first and only ever World Bank mission to North Korea. And contrast that with my latest visit, which was in September 2013. After Kim Jong-un had begun to put his mark on economic strategy and development policy,
And then I want to talk briefly about four dynamics of change in the economic system that I see really critical in the present time and set the context for how we think about relating to that system going forward. So I visited North Korea in February 1998. It was the depth of the famine. It was at the low point of the economic collapse of North Korea that occurred in the mid-1990s. Just to give you an illustration, North Koreans don't produce many numbers, but they do publish a budget, usually in April. And in 1998, the budget was one half of the level in North Korean won that they published in 1994. And in a command economy, the budget's pretty close to being a representative of the total output, which meant that the economic contraction of North Korea over that four-year period was about 50%, which is rather extraordinary. So into this mill, I met with economic officials mainly, and I just want to relate a conversation I had with a director of the central bank. I asked him, how do you get to an exchange rate for the North Korean won to the U.S. dollar of 2.16? And he looked at me and he said, "Well, February 16th is Kim Jong Il's birthday." And then he said, "Can I ask you a question? Can you just explain to me the difference between macroeconomics and microeconomics? People use these words, but we don't understand what you're talking about." Now this is very revealing. I'm not in Kansas anymore. This is a country that doesn't understand even the most elemental concepts of economics as we understand them in market economies. I went back to the World Bank board after meeting people and having conversations, and I made two comments to the World Bank board about my visit, my observation. One is that they will need to learn how to deal with market economies, both because all of their external trade parties, Russia and China and former Comecon countries, were all transitioning into market economies, and they had to figure out how to deal with that. And secondly, by the time I was there, the PDS system, the public distribution system, had collapsed, which contributed to the famine, and the farmers' markets had emerged as a grassroots response so that people could find a way to meet basic family needs. And the domestic emergence of that domestic market economy was real, and it was growing. Even in 1998, it was a factor. And they were going to have to learn to deal with what it meant to have market dynamics inside the country, not just in their trading partners. So I also commented to the World Bank board that ignorance about economics is just as much an obstacle to their being able to find their way out of the woods and do things that we would consider sensible as socialist ideology. And if you want to influence the way they manage themselves and their relations with other partners, it's necessary to go beyond simply the humanitarian response and to think about knowledge engagement to help them acquire the knowledge, to help them be more able to understand their predicament economically and find practical ways to deal with it. And a number of governments and NGOs did pursue over the years following that a knowledge engagement component of their relationship with North Korea beyond simply humanitarian aid. And we can talk about that more in the discussion. But the North Koreans also, later that year, began to take steps on their own. And many people don't realize this, but they amended the Constitution in September of 1998 to make legal the idea that North Korean enterprises could actually have profits. And they also reorganized the cabinet in October and in November to eliminate commissions as formulators of policy and integrate them with ministries so that the integration of policy formulation and implementation was put in a structure that looked a lot more normal to the way most governments are organized and run their economic affairs. And then they followed that reorganization with beginning to put younger people into more senior management jobs. So they recognized that they needed to do things. And that's set the context for the economic reforms that were announced in 2002 and 2003, which caught the world's attention. And they were imperfect, but they were significant. And we could talk more about that later. Fast forward to 2013. I attended a international academic conference in Pyongyang on the subject of special enterprise zones and what they could learn from international experiences that might be helpful for them, because Kim Jong-un had signed off on a strategy to develop special economic zones as a way of attracting foreign investment, to bringing in technology transfer and helping them to earn foreign exchange in a different kind of way than the Kaesong framework. And there were, I think, 9 academics from various Asian and North American countries. This was organized by the Knowledge Partnership Program at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, as part of their engagement framework. And what was striking to me about that conference was it was like any conference we might have here at LSE. There were presentations that were well organized with PowerPoint in English and Korean. There were good questions from the audience that had about 90 North Koreans in it, roughly the same as maybe about the same as we have here today. There were good presentations from the North Koreans, and we had a good discussion. And there were some offline conversations over lunches and dinners that allowed a more in-depth understanding of the things that they were working on and concerned about. And I came away with that feeling that the intellectual ceiling had been lifted from where I was in 1998 way up here. And you could have a different openness of conversation about economic strategies and issues than I thought was possible. And it was an eye-opener for me. The other thing that happened during that visit I wanted just to mention was I had a conversation with a young professor from Kim Il-sung University who told me that he had been on the program at the University of British Columbia, spoke English well enough for me to speak with him personally. And he said that he had access to the internet and was on the World Bank website every day studying about knowledge economy and what different countries were doing in developing, applying knowledge economy concepts to their situation. And I thought that was very interesting, and he was incorporating this in his research and his studies. But then 3 months later, in the January 1st New Year's editorial that's published every year as a national statement, a speech by Kim Jong-un, about their policies going forward, all of a sudden there's a paragraph about how they're going to give priority to developing the knowledge economy. That said to me that there's something going on in the way in which this kind of research and exposure to outside knowledge was being integrated into the internal mechanisms for setting their own economic thinking and strategy. And it left me with the opinion that knowledge engagement with North Korea doesn't mean that we get a seat at the table. It's very hard to sit down and talk policy reform with North Koreans. They're very uncomfortable. But it doesn't mean that we can't influence the quality of the debate and information that exists internally as they seek ways to make a more rational approach to developing their economy, quote, in their own style. And I do think that's an illustration of the impact of knowledge engagement with North Korea. The last story I want to tell about that visit was a visit to the beer factory, which they bought wholesale from Scotland and reassembled in Pyongyang. And I talked to the manager of the factory about how they do their business, and he said, "Well, we're making 70,000 kiloliters of beer a year, of which 60,000 we make for the state plan, and 10,000 we sell to the market. And we take the profits that we get from the part we sell to the market, and we roll that into expanding our production facility so we can do more, and we give bonuses to our staff so their performance will be better." That's an illustration of the fact that many state enterprises now in Pyongyang are actively involved in, have 1 foot in the market economy and 1 foot in the state economy. And that leads to the first of the themes that I want to mention, which is that North Korea is now truly a mixed economy. Some estimates are that the market economy accounts for about 30% of GDP, but it's true that the boundaries between the state system and the market activities are getting increasingly blurry, and we can talk more about how that's happening in the discussion. Another aspect of that is that there is a significant change in the political economy dynamics in North Korea, that the private entrepreneurs, what are called the Dongju, are really having a major impact in organizing production activities, providing capital for financing working capital and new investments in new businesses, and they're acquiring quite a bit of economic power, which is meaning that they don't have to rely on state subsidies of the PD or the public distribution system, and potentially are building entourages of support of relationships and economic power that is threatening to the regime. And that leads to a very interesting new dynamic of the relationship of this newly economically powerful elite and the way the regime functions and how it deals with them. The third theme is the evolution of the implicit social contract. Most North Korean families now earn their livelihoods through market activities, not through relying on state income or the public distribution system. As people become more involved in markets, more involved in exercising freedoms of consumer choice, making decisions on their own in their own interests, they're becoming a lot less attached to the old loyalty system that was mentioned earlier as a way of maintaining stability in the country. And the younger people particularly, the people I've met under 40, they're all focused on the future. They've all grown up with markets in their lives, and they have a very different idea of the future than what many people think about the way people in North Korea actually live. And we can talk about more of that. And the last thing I want to mention as a theme is the impact of sanctions. And we talked a bit about that this morning. But I see sanctions as a double-edged sword. It's not just the difficulties that it's putting on the regime to raise foreign exchange. It's also changing the incentives environment, both for state and non-state actors, and giving them reasons to do things that will be more economically rational and to make changes in their economic behaviors that will make more efficient use of domestic resources for economic development. And there are some very interesting aspects of that, including shifting their foreign exchange earning activities into non-sanctioned exports and trying to deepen domestic value added in those exports to have more benefit, pursuing import substitution, not just because it's ideological and supports the Juche philosophy, because it reduces the demand for foreign exchange in the domestic system and produces new kinds of jobs and for the local economy. And I can give examples of that. It's also giving Dongju and others reasons to think about redeploying the coal that was supposed to be exported to China into domestic uses in new and creative ways. And and most importantly, from my point of view, the sanctions focus on, at least the ones last year, focused on enterprises that earnings that could be directly related to military enterprise benefits. And it's true that in the history of North Korea, there is a siloed approach to the economy. The military had their own production companies, trading companies, and banks supporting them. Same with the party, same with the people's economy under the cabinet. That siloing was a major source of inefficiency in the domestic economy. But with the way sanctions are structured, it's giving the North Koreans an incentive to put the production enterprises under the cabinet, which are not directly linked to the military, and then to provide resources to the military through the budget, the way a lot of countries do. What that is doing is it's enabling the North Korean cabinet to exercise more control over the economic strategy that they have been given by Kim Jong-un, and potentially the ability to have macroeconomic management in a way that they've never been able to achieve before, particularly in monetary affairs with supervision of the banking system. So with that, I'll leave it for now, and we can come back to comments and questions later. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for challenging some conventional wisdom and guiding us through 20 years of marketization history in 10 minutes. If we can move to Curtis's presentation now. Thank you.
All right, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm a little jet lagged from coming to this side of the pond, so please bear with me. I've been given the daunting task of giving you a 5 minutes overview of the North Korean economy. So Kim Jong-un has been in power for a little over 5 years now, so it's perhaps a good time to take stock of how the country looks since he's had time to see the way things are and implement his own policy changes. I wanted to start off first with an overview of the North Korean media. These are the typical kinds of economic projects that are highlighted in the North Korean media. If you watch KCTV or read Nodong Sinmun, a lot of you South Korean students might be surprised to learn that you can read KCNA and Nodong Sinmun on the internet here. Every time we get South Korean interns in Washington, they're surprised they can watch North Korean television on the internet. These are the typical things you see. But perhaps what's more interesting are the things that you don't see in the North Korean media. That's what this list is. The first thing I wanted to point out was the growth in the size and the number of official markets. That's something I've kept a close watch on through satellite imagery. A lot of people have a tendency to refer to all market activity in North Korea as black market activity, and this is just not accurate. I've counted nearly 440 official marketplaces in North Korea and close to 100 new and renovated and expanded markets in the Kim Jong-un era. We've also heard nebulous rumblings of our style economic management. Bradley just mentioned it a few moments ago as well, where specific policies like the June 28th measures and the May 30th measures aimed at corporate governance in enterprise, state-owned enterprises, and at cooperative farms to change the fiscal incentives in those organizations. We know that they've kind of been rolled out on a trial basis, but they haven't been nationally implemented, and it's hard to know exactly how widespread they're being used at the moment. There have also been changes in monetary, fiscal, and financial management, which are spoken of off the record, but are not mentioned directly in the official media. And then this last bit here is just my personal model that I believe they're pursuing. I have a typo, I shouldn't have capitalized that G. I believe they are implementing limited economic adjustments. They're not doing anything to upend the bureaucratic management of the system or anything that would compromise the authority of the Korean Workers' Party or of Kim Jong-un. There's certainly, I put opening and reform in quotes because we have a tendency to use them, but the North Koreans will not use them at all. It's also very difficult to know how big North Korea's economy is. We can't even say with any kind of scientific accuracy what their GDP is. We estimate the South Korean Bank of Korea and the American Central Intelligence Agency put it between $28 and $30 billion a year at purchasing power parity. And Kim Jong-un took over in 2012, so basically he's gotten plus or minus 1% since then. For what it's worth, most economists outside of the government in America believe that these numbers understate the actual level of growth. We can't say scientifically what the level of growth actually is, but the methodology that's used to generate the national income accounts was developed in the 50s to estimate the size of the Soviet economy. It has a number of drawbacks, which we don't have any solutions for. And one of the big problems is it doesn't incorporate services as a area of production. So this doesn't include black market activity, which would be largely in the service sector. So this is an official market. This is in Sariwon, which is the capital of North Hwanghae Province. And this is a new one. This was built in 2014. It's still under construction here. They're building the roof over it. These are people trading in the market. These people who are trading in the market are legally employed there. They're women. And they have ID badges that say they're employed in that market. They pay fees to rent stalls on the benches, and they pay tax based on their sales. And The tax money supports the local government and the regular police, the Ministry for People Security, not the Ministry for State Security, which is the KGB. The regular police patrol these just as they do the regular streets. These markets are also fully integrated in the public finance system. This is an unofficial market in Naknang-guyok in southern Pyongyang. You can see people on the streets. And this is a mass, spontaneous gathering of vendors. Of course, it's also tolerated by the regime, but not in the same way. These people are here part-time. This is not their official job. They're just selling things for some extra money. And this is also a rural phenomenon. This is in North Hwanghae Province. There's two clusters of people, one here on the left and another one on the right. It's about 0.7 of a kilometer from one end to the other, to give you a sense of scale. These are thousands of people meeting in an unorganized way out in the countryside. And if you notice, there's no supporting infrastructure here. There's no buses that brought people. These people came on bicycle or walked, and they carried things. And they're conducting their market activity here in this dried river basin during the day, and they're going home. I've identified several of these in satellite imagery. Of course, they're hard to identify because they're not regular. These are taking place as well throughout the country. One great thing that has happened for North Korean people under Kim Jong-un, I shouldn't say great, but one positive development, is the massive inflation that took place between the currency reform in 2009 and 2012 has come to an end. The black market value of the North Korean won has basically been stable since Kim Jong-un took over. In 2009, the official exchange rate was 100 won per dollar. Now it's about 8,000 won per dollar. And the reason I wanted to show you this was because 2009 is the last time official salaries were set in North Korea, so people's official salaries have not changed since then, even though the value of their salaries has declined rapidly. So if you were making 2,500 won here, that would be $25. $25, sorry, I don't know what the pounds calculation is. But on the other end of that graph, it's only 20 or 30 cents per month. So that gives you a sense of how important side activity and market activity is for North Korean people. It's essential for people to earn outside of their official jobs. If you guys want to talk about North Korea's international trade volume, we can do so in the Q&A. Of course, China is the big story there. And Brad mentioned the special economic zones. North Korea's announced 24 since Kim Jong-un came to office. They announced 14 in 2013, they announced 7 in 2014, and they announced 3 in 2015, and they announced 0 in 2016. I think that they've finally given up announcing new SEZs and decided to focus on the ones that are already there. So there's an ideological campaign going on as part of his legitimacy as well that none of us would consider reformist or.
Just a thought maybe at the end is that of course it's a very good thing if he really wants, and as he has said, to tie his rulership to the economic welfare of his people. That's very good. Of course, one asks what is the accountability mechanism that ensures that. Exactly. So that is a big question mark. And as long as he uses the security wild card, trump card, so to speak, in its over policy mix, this accountability can be very easily avoided.
There was one comment about illicit activities. I just wanted to point out every person in this room has conducted an illicit activity. And how many of you were ideologically motivated?
Right, indeed. If you have any further questions, don't hesitate to chorus over lunchtime. In the meantime, thanks to Brad, to Curtis and Proshka. Do we want to come back at 1:30? Who's in charge here? Or would you like to push back a few minutes?